As Mayor Lenny Curry calls for more money to fight violent crime, Jacksonville records another homicide over the weekend. Just ahead, a closer look at this city's high murder rate spiking yet again as we take your calls. Good Monday morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. The podcast is on iTunes and Stitcher. Make sure you subscribe and watch the show, video on demand, at tvjax.com. Just ahead, we want your calls on Jacksonville's violent crime spike as calls grow louder to take stronger action. Criminologist Mick Hallett will join us in a moment at 549-2937. Also, this morning, the 9th annual 26.2 with Donna takes over the beaches this weekend. An update on the cutting-edge cancer research the marathon supports. Then later, Culpepper on the Broncos' route in the Super Bowl, plus one local ad exec gives his take on the commercials from the big game. Were you a little underwhelmed? All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, as politicians and pastors speak out once again in Jacksonville, saying much more needs to be done to stop the city's spiking murder rate, mourners laid to rest the 13th homicide victim of the year Saturday. 22-month-old Aiden Michael McClendon was shot by a stray bullet on January 29th as he sat inside a parked car. Police are investigating this possibly gang-related shooting. But Jacksonville has been here before, of course, many times. The city has been Florida's murder capital on and off for more than a decade now. As Mayor Lenny Curry works to reinvigorate the Jacksonville Journey Anti-Crime Initiative, first started back in 2008, we're going to begin the hour this morning with a closer look at the city's violent crime problem, root causes, and what one expert says needs to be done about it. Dr. Michael Hallett is a criminologist with the University of North Florida. He's written extensively about this issue, and he joins us now. Mick Hallett, good to see you.
Good morning.
And what are your thoughts about the city's spiking murder rate? 16 homicides so far for 2016. Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us. And so over the weekend, we saw a funeral for 22-month-old Aiden McClendon, not quite 2 years old, shot by a stray bullet. There have been many occasions like this, Mick Hallett, where an innocent child in this city is shot and killed by a stray bullet. And we see this incredible outpouring of anger, anguish, calls to do something. Mayor Lenny Curry is asking that about $500,000 for additional man hours to fight crime in the city of Jacksonville be put into, I believe, the Jacksonville Journey operating budget. That initiative first started under former Mayor John Payton when another little girl, Drishana Davis, was killed by a stray bullet that went through the walls of her home. Here we are again. I know that's what you're thinking. Here we go again.
Yes, indeed. Sadly, I think we've come full circle between 2006 and 2016. In the summer of 2006, there were actually two little girls shot, a girl named Shanice Holmes and Drishana Davis. And it was only after Drishana Davis got killed that action was taken. And
right.
There was the JCCI homicide study. I served on the management team for that. And that morphed later into what became the Jacksonville Journey. But we're at the same point in the river, sadly. Babies are killed. We have prayer and grieving appropriately and a scramble for money. And I think we're in the same position now.
Let's talk about the money. The Jacksonville Journey, a series of interlocking anti-crime initiatives founded by former Mayor John Payton, continued but downsized somewhat under Mayor Alvin Brown for a variety of reasons. Now being brought back in a robust fashion by Mayor Curry, the operating budget is about $5 million. Total. That's far less than was originally budgeted for this during the Payton administration. But let's talk about the journey. You are very familiar with how it works, and you have some thoughts about it.
I was on the oversight committee for 4 years under Mayor Payton at the founding of the journey, and then stepped off with the election of Mayor Brown. $5 million is almost a budgetary afterthought. It's nowhere near enough. The first budget for Jacksonville Journey under Mayor Payton was over like $35 million. About half of that went to saturation law enforcement and the other half went to programming. Sadly, though, even under Mayor Payton, in the second year, Jacksonville Journey was cut about in half because of the overlay of this other chronic problem we're dealing with called pension debt. So that until we get our house in order fiscally, we're going to continue to struggle for both law enforcement and programming resources for crime fighting and civic infrastructure in the city.
And so Mayor Lenny Curry is proposing a half-cent sales tax to pay down the city's massive pension liability. He's lobbying for assistance on this in Tallahassee as the state legislative session progresses. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I like the work ethic and trying to, you know, really tackle this problem. Sadly, I think, though, that a sales tax, being the most regressive kind of tax, reproduces the structural inequality at the root of crime in Jacksonville. So that in the consolidated government, you've got, a deindustrialized urban core surrounded by a white suburban perimeter. And under the auspices of consolidation, I think on the perimeter, you've got an electorate that is driven by a desire to have low taxes. And in the cratering urban core where crime is highest, you've got citizens in need. And so I think the structural contradictions of consolidation have broken down in regard to public safety. And I don't think it's working.
What do you think would work?
I think you need a millage increase to fund programs. I think as Mayor Payton used to argue for years, he argued, I think correctly, that Jacksonville's gotten off on the cheap for so long because of an artificially low millage rate. And I think that sort of dynamic of social relations of ignoring the needs of the inner city, frankly, is engendered by the politics of consolidation, which have only gotten worse in this era of redistricting and sort of hyper-politicized electorates.
We'll go to your calls for UNF criminologist Mick Hallett in just a moment. The number to join the show, 549-2937. And so you've been arguing this case for years. A millage rate, you think, that would be spread across everyone who owns property in this county is the way to go. Sales tax that affects anyone who buys goods in Duval. Why can you just explain a little further why you think millage is the way to do this?
Well, traditionally, sales taxes are used for physical infrastructure needs, like the Better Jacksonville Plan under Mayor Delaney. Built the library and some much needed and great assets were delivered to the city of Jacksonville as a result of Better Jacksonville. But traditionally, sales taxes are for critical infrastructure. Now, the proposal for the sales tax to deal with the pension debt problem is still unfolding, and it's not out of committee yet, and the two bills haven't been reconciled, so we don't know exactly what that'll look like yet. But at least as it's being promoted, it's a quote extension of Better Jacksonville, which it by definition, it's not an extension. It would be a new tax. And the one concern I have is that it wouldn't take effect until 2030 at the expiration of Better Jacksonville. If you're going to do a sales tax, why not just do it now? The other problem, though, I think, is that what will our needs be in 2030? I think you're compromising those precious assets for physical infrastructure to pay pension debt, which I think has been a longstanding problem. The first ever study of JCCI done in 1977 on local financing in Jacksonville said that the city, even in 1977, was underfunding its pensions. Mm. So the only time the pension situation in Jacksonville ever got really under control was under Delaney. Not because he raised taxes, but because he not laid off, but through attrition, shrunk the workforce by about a third. But there's never been an aggressive property tax agenda to build Jacksonville in the way it should be built, as a city rather than a county. The place is still run like a county.
And no political will to do so,
right?
Frankly. And so do you see that? Look at what John Payton went through,
right?
Putting through a very slight millage rate increase in his second term as a Republican mayor.
Yeah, that was a courageous thing, and he had to do it.
He paid a price for that politically. He took a lot of flack for that politically. Under Alvin Brown, Mayor Brown, for 4 years, pledged not to raise taxes at all. Do you think it was because he saw that kind of pushback that his predecessor saw in office?
No question. I mean, Alvin Brown was elected by a very slim margin and became an effect, de facto Tea Party conservative with regard to taxation and infrastructure resources for the city. But let's go back to the homicide problem and the violence problem. We have led, you know, 25 years, Little Page did a story. We've, you know, arguably structurally in terms of resources ignored the problem of violence in the inner city with a few very minor exceptions. If you want to deal with violence in Jacksonville, you've got to deal with that contradiction built into the code of consolidation where you've got a deindustrialized core surrounded by a white suburban prosperous suburb. So those are two different sort of
political
systems.
And how do you deal with that?
Well, you know, Shorstein used to call it the Tale of Two Cities, and I think he was absolutely right about that. And until we reconcile all the contradictions built into that structure by providing resources and embracing Jacksonville's identity as a city as opposed to a county, these problems are going to persist.
Let's go to your calls right now as we speak with UNF criminologist Mick Hallett, 549-2937. Anastasia is downtown. Hi, Anastasia. Good morning.
I don't disagree at all with Mr. Malice's what he's saying, but I wanted to point out that the monies that Mayor Curry is proposing to use were specifically tagged to use for proactive measures to stop inner city crime, and that the proposal to use that to now fund overtime for police officers is not how the funding was supposed to go, and we need to take proactive measures to help stop the violence.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think that's a misperception. The money for overtime, the short-term money for overtime was going to come out of the current Jacksonville Journey money. The sales tax, which hasn't been even passed yet, those monies aren't even available. So I think there are so many still open questions about the proposal that we can't even really speak to it. But, the nice thing about a millage rate from my perspective, if you call yourself a fiscal conservative, is that a millage rate is adjustable every year. A sales tax, will it go for 15 years? A sales tax, has an extended life and arguably taxes citizens at a higher rate, especially poor citizens, than a millage rate would. So I'm not convinced about the sales tax proposal. Maybe it'll be reconciled in such a way that it can work. But for me, the traditional way to build civic infrastructure is through appropriately levied property taxes.
John on the South Side. Hi, John. How are you?
Hello. Good. How are you?
All right.
Am I on the air?
Mm-hmm.
Great. I just wanted to share, I guess, maybe some frustration that maybe a lot of people have out there. It's like it's kind of cultural that is an issue where when something is wrong in a certain neighborhood, that people are turning outward saying that it's all these problems outside that's causing these problems, which would be these drive-by shootings, these murders, these horrific acts in certain neighborhoods and communities. And it's blamed on lack of jobs, which is true, but a way to get to the jobs is to focus on educating our children to the point where they're qualified for jobs. And in certain neighborhoods, there are certain element of local inner city terrorism by groups of people ruining and destroying neighborhoods. So I guess it's like addressing those people who are destroying neighborhoods by going around with their guns and shooting people, stopping that. But again, not looking for these root causes, finding the root causes, which is really education, for people focusing on education to be successful Americans, regardless of what neighborhoods they're from. It's getting to that point that solves the solutions.
That's John on the South Side. Thanks for the call, John.
Yeah, I think it's important to have a conversation about what living inside a deindustrialized urban core really means. I mean, first of all, there's a lot of what criminologists call structural violence. There are forces at work in the lives of people that harm them that are beyond the control of those individuals who experience those forces. So, example, a young child on the North Side whose father's in prison and who's living with his grandmother who is functionally illiterate has to step up and take the FCAT, compared to a kid on the South Side whose both parents are together. And, you know, when he gets home, he's met with mom and a snack and the geometry textbook, right?
Right.
So those two are going to live very different lives and have very different self-understandings. And until we start to reconcile those gaps, I mean, I don't disagree that family breakdown is at the root of all urban crime problems and many other social problems. But the fact is that no government program is going to ever be able to put family back together. So what do we do? How many of you have ever had a coach or a teacher or a pastor, someone you looked up to that had a huge influence on your life? Programs do work.
The Harlem Children's Zone in New York has seen some success with its cradle to college, incredible array of wraparound services, literally wrapping its arms around kids in urban core neighborhoods and their parents or whoever the caregiver might be. Now, here in Jacksonville, we have the Newtown Success Zone, which is modeled after the Harlem Children's Zone, mm-hmm. around the area of Edward Waters College, trying to do this very thing you're talking about, Mick, trying to help children that are facing structural violence.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about whether or not it's making a difference?
Well, there is a lot of good news. Programs like that. Jacksonville has a very robust nonprofit sector. We're blessed with tremendous resources in the nonprofit sector that are very active. Let's talk a little bit about Jacksonville Journey. I was on the Oversight Committee for 4 years, and I think it's an excellent program, and here's why I think so, because it's performance-based. All the contracts awarded through Jacksonville Journey are performance-based contracts. So, and I'm sure under Mayor Curry they will be as well, where if a program is underperforming, they lose their funding. And the programs that perform are rewarded with extra funding. And every month, the Oversight Committee meets and holds those programs accountable. So this is not just a typical grant program where, you know, the organization gets the money and reapplies next year. That's not how the Jacksonville Journey was set up. So that, you know, pound for pound or, you know, dollar for dollar, penny for penny, Jacksonville Journey programs are well worth the money. Let me say one other thing about inner city deterioration. I mean, programs do work. It's just very hard to measure because when programs work, and the Jacksonville Journey focused on literacy, after school care, public health initiatives, not just traditional crime programs, which was a real strength of it. But when these programs work, those citizens move. They leave the inner city and leave behind even weaker citizens who, you know, continue to live there in an even weaker state. But when programs work, it's very hard to measure because the people who they benefit actually leave the neighborhood affected.
And it makes it hard to justify the continued investment if
right.
you can't measure
so
the
So it looks
impact.
Like they don't yeah. work, but they do.
Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much. I just wanted to say that, one, I totally agree with what he's saying about the taxes, especially the property tax versus the sales tax, and also add that property tax has much more stability than sales tax, which, of course, is going to fluctuate based on how much consumer spending is going on. Then also the broken families, I totally agree with everything you said so far on that. And the one thing I want to add at this point is I think churches have a role to play here in helping out these families that are struggling. There's a family on the West Side, the Gandhi family, working through Abundant Life Church. It's really been working in the community on the West Side to establish help for the children at need. And I think that's what the community as a whole needs to be doing.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. Faith programs are invaluable. Sports programs, you know, how many young males' lives are driven by a good coach? My own son, I would say, is someone who listens to his coach at least as much as me. let's talk about consolidation a little bit here for a moment. I think consolidation is a different animal today than it was when it started, and the politics of taxation for programs are even an even heavier lift. I mean, Mayor Curry has inherited a hugely complex, difficult burden with the pension debt. And, you know, we really do need to come together and support a millage tax increase and not take it out on the politicians who are saying what needs to be said, just like Mayor Payton had the courage to do.
Richard in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Richard. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Great conversation. You guys have touched on so much. It'll take five shows to really peel back all the layers, but I'm going to try and cut right through all of them equally in another minute. Number one, the problem that we have is that we put the people on one side and the police on the other side, and then we tell the people through the politicians and the preachers, we've got to get money from you over here to the police to stop this particular issue. The problem is when we say the word violent crime, the community that's on the outer core doesn't see themselves as the violent crime problem. The earlier caller who said, in essence, these people in these inner core have to pull themselves up by their own bootstrap, educate themselves, you know, take care of their families. And then it's the deterioration of the family that's at the core of the problem. That's a lie, because it's the deterioration of the family that's the result of a problem. And the problem is the deterioration of this city through consolidation. And right after, on the heels of slavery, on the heels, all those kinds of things, and we're still seeing the remnants of that. Mayor Curry won by talking to the outer core about what he was going to do to the inner core. And now he's trying to govern by what he's going to talk about taking from the inner core to ensure the outer core doesn't have to worry. What we need to do is this, is stop measuring the success of a program simply by the turnstile that you put at the door. There's not a nonprofit program that you go into that doesn't ask you to sign in. Because at the end of the year, all they're going to do is count the number of signatures and the amount of money and make that the determination. And then as far as Newtown Success Zone, it should be the Newtown Failure Zone. Because when that zone got started, there was about 30, maybe 20 gangs in that community. Today, there are 54 gangs that the police department can tell you are there. How can you call that success and be a zone? And all it's doing is containing crime. So here's my suggestion. You said it earlier, the millage rate. Because we can put the millage rate. I'm a homeowner, and I don't mind paying more taxes. And I know that there are not too many homeowners on the north side, but I don't mind paying more taxes. But I know that those on the south side will have a big issue with it. And Mayor Curry, like Mayor Brown, will not be able to win an election if he has to explain to these home-owning voters that I took money from your house to give over to these kids. But we cannot have another child to die. That's all I'm saying. And if we keep pitting our children with letting the politicians pit our children against their votes every 4 years or so, we're going to be right back in this problem again. I run a program called Guiding Success that teaches children to play violin from kindergarten to college. My daughter's a freshman at Stetson. But do you know I have the biggest challenge of getting a positive story about anything we're doing? The moment I tell them I got a violin because children got murdered, then the media is over here. We've got to stop the labels. And Melissa, I'm going to tell you this. You are the key, because you're the only person in this city that gives a platform to stories being told without some sort of media bias and giving people like me an opportunity to express what I really feel. And I apologize for going on like this, but it's going to take five shows and five conversations just to begin to talk about what the issues are.
You know, we've done a lot more than five shows on this topic, Richard, but you know what? Thank you so much. And we'll keep doing it. We will keep doing it. And I so appreciate your thoughts. Thanks, Richard. That was a really important call, I think. Let me also say that, as you well know, McCallett, I served on one of the original Jacksonville Journey subcommittees, and it inspired me to make a documentary about this issue years ago called The 904. You could watch that documentary today, and, you know, nothing's really changed.
That's right.
It's all the same.
It's sad, you know, and I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, as they say. You know, if you read the JCCI homicide study, I was on the management team for it, study summer 2006. It lays out short-term, long-term goals. You know, short-term goals is to address, you know, send out the police. But there are only two short-term goals and some 15 long-term goals. The first long-term goal is address the structural inequality in economics. In race relations and social equality, inequality in Jacksonville.
And do you feel that since that study was published, any progress has been made on that front?
Well, you know, we got hit with the economic downturn, which didn't help anyone. I think there is a kind of a congenital defect in the structure of consolidation, in that the interests of suburban voters are pitted against the needs of urban voters. And of course, sadly, urban folks live in a situation that lacks stability. for those reasons of structural violence that I talked about. If you live in a deindustrialized zone, which is the, you know, health zone one in Jacksonville, the deficits of citizens that they inherit when they're born into the neighborhood, people like Kevin Gay talk about all the time, you know, you're really almost in a zip code prison. You're constrained by your available resources. You're pushed out.
It's naive. In other words, it's naive, as well intentioned as the sentiment might be. It's naive to say we've just got to give these kids a good education. It's so much more than that.
Well, you know, It's not just fiscal capital. It's social capital. The real crisis we face as a nation is social capital. Is social bonds and the connections and relationships people have in suburban versus urban environments. And what's really collapsed and why you have so much illicit drug market violence, why do gangs take over inner cities is because illicit drug markets are the primary economy.
We will continue following this story. It's been a long absence for you on the show because you've been writing a book.
Right.
We couldn't get to that today, but I hope you'll come back and share that with us the next time.
Glad to. Thank you.
Mick Hallett is a criminologist with the University of North Florida. If you only caught part of this discussion, we'll have the podcast up later today at wjctnews.org, also at iTunes and Stitcher. Well, much more still ahead later in the hour. Cole Pepper on Super Bowl 50. We'll also take a look at those ads that ran during the game. But up next, the 9th annual Donna Marathon weekend is coming up in a few days. Stay with us.
When it comes to redeveloping downtown Jacksonville, the best-laid plans have often turned sour because of spiraling costs or problems with infrastructure. But despite setbacks, the city has made strides in recent years. In Community Thread Downtown Developing, we talk with the movers and shakers who are transforming downtown and meet others who say challenges still remain. Log on to wjct.org/events/community-thread to submit your questions or to RSVP to be part of our studio audience on February 11th.
My name is Max. My world is fire and blood.
What does the new Mad Max Fury Road film have in common with the animated film Happy Feet? Australian director George Miller, who wrote and directed both. He made his directing debut with the first Mad Max film in 1979 and also wrote the film Babe. Join us on the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hi, this is Michael Feldman, and thanks to WJCT and the Florida Theater, What Do You Know, Y'all? Is coming to Jacksonville on Saturday, February 20th. We're flying down to check out all 22 miles of beach, maybe do us some fish camping. Join us, won't you? Tickets are available at the Florida Theater box office, by phone at 904-355-2787, or online at floridatheater.com. We'll see you there.
Sponsored in part by Folio Media House.
Helen Blaze's Brewing Company is refurbishing a building in Melbourne, Florida that is more than a century old. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will uncover evidence of the building's past lives as a hardware store, mortuary, and pharmacy. We'll discuss publications of the Florida Geological Survey and Fort King from the Seminole War. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's the only marathon in the U.S. dedicated to breast cancer research and care. The 9th annual Donna Marathon weekend is coming up this Friday through Sunday. 26.2 with Donna was founded in partnership with Mayo Clinic here in Jacksonville, and all the funds raised from this weekend will help to further important genomics research relating to breast cancer that's being done right here on the First Coast. Here with more, we're pleased to welcome back Marathon founder Donna Deegan. Always great to see you.
Good morning. Great to see you.
And Aubrey Thompson, PhD, co-director of the Mayo Clinic Breast Cancer Translational Genomics Program, Mayo Clinic, Florida. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning. It's nice to see you.
And so much important research being done at Mayo. We'll discuss that in a moment. But first, I can't believe it's the 9th year for this marathon. Donna Deegan, Look at what you've accomplished. My gosh.
Isn't that so exciting?
Yes.
9 years. I can hardly believe it. And so much progress on all fronts. I mean, I don't know that it could have gone better.
It's incredible. So it's coming up this Friday through Sunday out at the beaches. The website is breastcancermarathon.com.
Yep.
People do need to be aware of traffic changes and such. But you conceived of this, of course. You're a 3-time breast cancer survivor yourself. You love to run. And you conceived of this as a way to raise awareness and raise money for research.
Well, not only research, which is obviously extremely important, but also for the Donna Foundation, which funds the needs of underserved women in the area. So two very important things.
And over the 9 years, how has the Donna Foundation grown and expanded on its original concept?
Well, if you can believe it, Melissa, we're now approaching 10,000 women and men that we've been able to help with their critical needs. And, you know, the way that things have gone, we started out paying mostly things like mortgages and childcare, and now it seems we've morphed into a lot of medical bills. A lot of deductibles are higher and folks have a great need. So we really we're helping more people, and we need to raise more money.
Absolutely. And the money being raised, Dr. Thompson, as Donna said, it goes to help local women and some men and their families with the costs associated with breast cancer. At the same time, you've got some important updates on genomics research at Mayo Clinic that this event helps to further. So much incredible work is always being done at Mayo, but what can you tell us when it comes to breast cancer research?
Well, I think this is probably one of the most exciting periods that you could possibly be involved in. And, you know, the continued support that we've had from the 26.2 with Donna has just been a major factor in terms of our ability to really begin to take breast cancer apart and to understand some aspects of the disease that are going to be therapeutically very important, that are going to help us identify women who are going to benefit from certain drugs or not benefit from certain drugs. And the really exciting part, I guess, is going forward is we're beginning to understand now the link between the immune system and breast cancer and how that can be used therapeutically and just what the basic biology of that is. It's completely revolutionized, I think, the way that I view breast cancer.
How so? Can you give us an example?
Well, you know what? I sort of grew up thinking of breast cancer as being a malignant cell, and, you know, there was a cancer cell, and that was a cancer cell that we were going to have to deal with. But the reality now, as we understand it, is it's the way that that cancer cell interacts with other cells, normal cells in the body, the way the cancer cell interacts with the cells that are around it in the breast, and really fundamentally the way the cancer cell interacts with the immune system and the way the immune system interacts with that. And we're really beginning to use this genomic technology to take apart those details and to understand those kinds of interactions and to develop new therapeutic approaches based on that understanding. It's phenomenally exciting.
It really is. And survival rates have gone up every single year for so many hundreds of thousands of women due in part to this kind of work.
Well, you know what makes me so excited, Melissa, is you can really see it happening. I mean, the idea of having a vaccine that would be trialed for a particularly tough type of breast cancer, triple negative breast cancer, didn't even exist when we started this project. So the fact that we've been able to use the money from the marathon to seed fund these projects that have turned into really such a big deal, I really think we're going to, I mean, I remember talking to Dr. Thompson last year, and he said, I honestly believe in 20 years we're not going to have breast cancer. I mean, that's how exciting is that for our daughters?
That is incredibly exciting. Gosh, wouldn't we love to see that? Now, in the meantime, this weekend is a big weekend for you and for everyone in this community and just for Jacksonville generally, because this is a worldwide event. What do people need to know about this event, the 26.2 with Donna? It's a whole weekend of events, actually, Friday through Sunday.
It is. The expo opens on Friday, what I should say first is online registration closes tomorrow at midnight. So if you haven't registered, Relay's about 75% full, so go ahead and get registered. Expo opens Friday. Saturday we have the 5K, and this is really cool. We're having a costume contest.
Oh.
And the winner of the costume contest gets 2 tickets to see Melissa Etheridge, who is awesome.
Oh, very nice.
So that's going to be fun. And then, of course, you have the marathon and the half and the relay on Sunday. So all kinds of great fun things happening.
People will be able to come out and meet you, see you out there running, of course.
Now, and we want everybody to come out and cheer for us, too. We're coming off the beach this year, so we're still running on the roads, but we're not on the actual sand.
Oh, okay.
So we want everybody in the community out there with their cowbells and their you know, the JTA shuttle will be out there. People can ride that back and forth. It'll be great.
Doctor, are you going to be running in this marathon?
my running days are long behind me, but I will say this. You know, I'm always there for the start of the marathon, and it's inspirational to see the enthusiasm that those individuals bring to fighting breast cancer, to finishing breast cancer. Inspires me. It makes me want to go back in the laboratory and work harder.
Wow. Well, it's such a pleasure to have both of you, and I cannot believe it's coming up on 9 years. I remember the first year when I was still at First Coast News, and I covered the press conference when you announced this.
10th anniversary is your year to run, Melissa, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Get
maybe
a whole
the 5K.
Year. Whole
I don't know
year.
About the 26 miles. But, you know, my daughter is in Girls on the Run, and she's already done several 5Ks. So.
I love it.
So she could easily do that with me.
All right. Fantastic.
Well, again, it is the 26.2 with Donna. It's Donna Marathon Weekend. This weekend at the beaches, so be part of it. Be aware of changes in traffic patterns. It's a big weekend for the First Coast. Marathon founder Donna Deegan and Dr. Aubrey Thompson, co-director of the Mayo Clinic Breast Cancer Translational Genomics Program. So good to see you both. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your support, Melissa.
Surely. And still ahead, Culpepper's recap from the Super Bowl, plus a look at which commercials won the night.
You see a house, you like it, you want to buy it.
When I first saw the house, I looked through, all right, this man, I want it, write the papers.
Not always so easy, though, in very low-income places. I'm Kai Rizdahl, the promise of Promise Zones in South Carolina, next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio. The sky
is crying. This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Jhumpa Lahiri won a Pulitzer Prize for her writing in English, so why did she decide to write her latest book in Italian?
I think what is so attractive to me about this path in Italian is that no one expected me to do it.
Jhumpa Lahiri on Defying Expectations on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Getting gaming culture to another level.
See, you want to play the same game because it's more fun to play the same game. If you want to play a multiplayer game, you don't want to play a game that nobody's playing because that wouldn't be any fun.
USC's women-driven gaming school wants to open video gaming to a wider audience and deeper experiences. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Catherine Burns, one of the hosts of the Moth Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us here on 89.9 WJCT. With true personal stories told live without notes to standing room crowds around the world, Moth stories aren't part of the disposable daily information flow. They stick with you, and you'll even find yourself retelling them. Listen Saturdays at 3 p.m. here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, there's still time to reserve your spot for the great First Coast Connect treasure hunt on Jekyll Island. Join travel expert Judy Wells and me at the new Seaside Westin Hotel up on Jekyll. It's along the beautiful Georgia coast. This is happening February 19th and 20th as we host a Friday night wine tasting and a Saturday beachcombing scavenger hunt for those famous Jekyll Island glass globes. that have become a beloved island tradition. Three-course gourmet dinner and breakfast also included. Judy and I are going to host all of the meals and wine tastings and lead the treasure hunt across the island. Join us. It's going to be so much fun. You can get all the details at Judy's website, wellsworld.net. Well, Super Bowl 50 was a triumph for Peyton Manning and Beyoncé last night at the halftime show. But just as many of us were watching the game for the commercials as the action on the field. So which advertisers scored and which didn't really do so well? David Bonner, executive creative director with the local advertising firm On Ideas, is here now with his thoughts about last night's Super Bowl. And David, $5 million a spot, isn't that a record?
Wow, it is a record. It's 166 a second, I think. So,
man,
you know, if you have a few million just laying around, I think you could.
Yeah, sure, why not? So now, according to USA Today, the top winner of last night's ad meter contest that they sponsored was Hyundai.
That's right.
Yeah.
Kevin Hart. So, you know, if I had my two cents about it, I think the winner last night really is storytelling. Overall, you know, if you think back of just great theorists on storytelling, Joseph Campbell, Hero's Journey, there were a lot of Hero's Journey spots last night. And Kevin Hart certainly was one with First Date.
Here's
for Hyundai.
Here's a little bit of audio of that ad in case you missed it last night.
Oh, you look good.
Thank you.
Hey, see the guy taking my little girl out, huh? Yep. Huh. You know what? Why don't you go ahead and take my new car? Thanks, Pops. Go ahead, baby. Watch this. Boom!
Kevin Hart really kind of won the night almost as much as Peyton Manning, didn't he?
That's right. Well, defense won the night last night, and I think, you know, all the advertisers were fairly conservative last night, but, you know, classic universal storytelling, I think, from Hyundai.
Who else stood out for you?
You know, I love the work from Helen Mirren and Budweiser. I think that's just fantastic. I mean, Helen's great and, you know, if anybody can really point a finger at drunk drivers and in a way for, you know, it's just a great mashup between Helen Mirren and Budweiser. It's just fantastic.
Right. She was sort of lecturing people who would drive drunk. And then a Jeep also seemed to kind of score.
You know, extraordinary story writing and extraordinary sort of just copywriting generally for both portraits and the 4x4 ever spots for Jeep. Really beautiful. I think, you know, particularly for your audience, these are just fantastic, very thoughtful ads.
And it seemed like it was sort of a lighter night, light and breezy and funny for the most part.
Anytime that you have sheep singing about love, I think that's a night I want to be part of. You know, that's hilarious. And then they had some really absurd work last night as well with Puppy Monkey Baby.
What was that all about? Yeah,
yeah, right. I think sometimes the writers, they drink too much of their product. And that particularly was for Mountain Dew. But I think a lot of folks are going to have nightmares about Puppy Monkey Baby for a while.
And in this area of streaming and YouTube and with so much internet traffic now being video driven, did any of the ads, do you think, have a shelf life beyond the game?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's like your show itself being on TV Jax now. I think being able to see and to hear, you know, what's going on. Certainly, those advertisers who showed their work on YouTube before the game are getting about 2.2 times the traffic they would ordinarily get, and you're already going to get, you know, 115 million viewers for the Super Bowl itself. So a great, great investment.
David Bonner is the executive creative director for On Ideas, a Jacksonville advertising agency, right down the street from us, actually, in downtown Jacksonville. Always good to see you. Thanks for joining us with your thoughts.
Thanks so much for having me. Thanks, Melissa.
Well, let's talk about the game as the Broncos win an historic and very defensive Super Bowl.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper, too?
And Peyton Manning had a little Budweiser, I think, Cole. So that was a little more free advertising for that particular company.
I was stunned, Melissa, to find a report that Peyton Manning didn't get paid anything for that, at least.
No product placement on that. Yeah.
Not yet. There may be a couple of truckloads of Bud backed up to his his place when he gets back home. But huge, by the way, that was no mistake. Manning did it twice. He did it once, in two different post-game interviews. That was not a slip of the tongue or just a, there's something going on there. The other thing you may have missed as far as the product placement is concerned with Peyton, uh-huh. and we'll get onto the game here. At the end of the game, as he came off the sideline, I don't know if you saw who he exchanged a cheek kiss with. It was Papa John.
No, I missed that.
And, Peyton owns a number of Papa John's franchises in the Denver area.
Okay.
And does the commercials with Papa John the whole bit. But so it was an odd night as far as sort of implied endorsement or even implicit endorsements that were thrown out there by the perhaps retiring Peyton Manning. We'll get to that in just a moment. The game, though, 24-10, all about the defense. Von Miller was the Super Bowl MVP. The pass rusher, who, by the way, is a free agent.
Uh-huh.
How would he look in a Jaguars uniform?
No, there you go.
It would be pricey, but the Jaguars have a lot of salary cap room that they actually have to spend mm-hmm. one way or another this year. So a guy to keep an eye on for sure. Former second pick of the draft in the same draft that Cam Newton was the first pick. That was 2011. And Newton, I thought, came out a little jazzed up. A lot of his passes were sailing high, which is usually an indication a guy's got too much energy and isn't really settled in. And I didn't think he got a lot of help from his receivers early on as well. Once you saw some drop passes and some errant passes, then the pass rush started taking effect from the Broncos, and that was really a big part of the game last night. Peyton Manning was not particularly effective. He was like a he was like a pitcher who was trying to throw strikes and let his defense do the work. It's clear his arm just wasn't there. I think he only completed two passes that traveled more than 10 yards beyond the line of scrimmage all game long. But it was enough. He talked about a game man. He's gone from being a surgical, strike force kind of quarterback mm-hmm. to now at the end of his career being a game manager. And it was enough to win 24-10. Now the big question.
Is he going to retire?
That's the big question. I'd be shocked if he came back, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah, why not go out on a high note like that?
Right, and so you would say, it's the perfect scenario, right? John Elway did it, although Elway did it winning back-to-back, and there was some thought, hey, no quarterback has ever won three straight Super Bowls. Could he come back and do it? I think because of Peyton Manning, all the neck surgeries, because of the pounding that his body has taken, and because his contract is up now, he'd have to go, sign a new contract somewhere. I don't know who would sign him. The rumor would be that a team moving to L.A. might want to have a marquee player to start in their first year to try to, attract some attention in that media market. But I don't see Peyton Manning coming back. He says he's not going to make his decision right away. Tony Dungy advised him to take some time.
Yeah.
Don't make an emotional decision.
Right.
So I suspect in the next couple of weeks we'll hear that Peyton Manning's going to hang him up.
All right. So Super Bowl 50 is in the books. Meanwhile, the Armada opened their preseason with a victory over Philadelphia.
And let me give kudos to the couple of thousand, I don't know what the number was by the time the game was well into halftime, who weathered the brutal conditions. I mean, it was cold and damp and windy and rainy. But the Armada supporters, hats off to you. I was up in a broadcast booth, and it was rough for me, much less people who were down in the stands. But the new coach, Tony Meola, saw his team win in his head coaching debut. He said after the game he thought the Armada was just a better team than the Union from the MLS. The lone goal was scored by a 21-year-old trialist named Charles Ulundu. A cool moment came late in the game when Gary Lewis, an Orange Park High School grad, got into the game. He had tried out for the Armada last year, then broke his leg in a game before the preseason ever started. I don't know if he's going to make the team or not, but a 29-year-old certainly had his great moment on the field. Yeah,
how about that?
Next up for the Armada, by the way, big rivalry matchup. Orlando City comes to town on Saturday, 6 o'clock at Community First Park of the baseball grounds.
Can we call them the hated Orlando City?
I think we probably should.
Like the hated Orlando Predators?
Yes, I think it makes perfect sense to do that.
Okay.
I'm hearing Orlando's going to bring a lot of fans, by the way, up, so need to rally the Armada faithful to get out there to make sure that Orlando doesn't take over the home field.
Very nice. And, of course, the most important news story of the week, as far as I'm concerned, curling is happening in downtown Jacksonville right now.
Yeah.
It's underway.
Yes, underway, and it'll be going all week. You and I are going to get out there and curl? Do a deep dive investigation on
the only curling I do involves something that I plug into a wall and apply to my hair.
I was going to say 12-ounce curls, but that's a whole different thing, I think, which you can apparently do quite a bit while watching and participating with this ancient and, frankly, pretty fun sport.
I think it's great. And, people need to people can come view this at the arena.
Yep, tickets are available there. And, curling has created become kind of a cult classic in a lot of ways as far as the Olympics are concerned, because you see it and you go, what next going on here?
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to experiencing curling in person for the first time this week.
I think it will be very exciting because Cole and I are going to walk over there to the arena and check this out. I'm not sure if it's today or tomorrow, but look for Cole's report on this on our air later in the week. And thanks so much for being with us, as always.
Thanks, Melissa.
Follow Cole on Twitter, at Cole Pepper, for updated sports news and notes any moment you check out his feed. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. This show's producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. Our podcast is up every day at iTunes and Stitcher. Make sure to subscribe. And you can watch the show now at Video On Demand. Go to the website tvjax.com. Next on Die and Ream, as parts of the U.S. prepare to contend with the Zika virus, experts are looking for ways to mitigate risk and make sure the public has accurate information. The latest on the spread and risks of the Zika virus. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.